Welcome to Game Store Profits. I'm your host, Daniel Fisher. And along with me, I have my green wizard Carolinas to my Peter Dickinson, Mike Perna.
No. What you're going to need to do is try that again.
I know.
You do not.
Let's do this. All right.
I'm just going to let you know right now.
It's Carolinas.
I'm keeping all of this in here.
No, you're not. I screwed up because I was off. You know,
I even let you get away with disrespecting our tagline sometimes. I will not let you get away with disrespecting one of the greatest pieces of animated fiction to ever exist. You will say that again, sir.
Okay. Welcome to Game Store Profits. I'm your host, Daniel Fisher. Along with me, I have the great... I've screwed this one up.
Deny me and you deny all magic.
Okay, hold on. Okay, here we go.
Do not make me quote this movie left, right, and sideways, because I will do it, sir. People are listening to you right now. You need to dig deep, because as it stands, people who don't listen to Barden Bible, I already have to explain what you're quoting after this is over, and I demand that you give
This is the thing, Mike. I really want to give this the best one. The best one that I can on this on anything. I've got to be perfect because this is one of my favorite.
Green Wizard Carolinas.
I know it's the Green Wizard Carolinas. But I just want to say it just right, just for you.
We're not even talking about the Golden Wizard Lotajal. We're talking about the Green Wizard Carolinas. Make it happen.
At least it didn't call you Amadon. Right. Welcome to Game Store Profits. I'm your host, Daniel. I screwed that one up already.
All right, let's just move on. We've already spent too much time on this.
I've got to get this right.
Okay. Here it is. For all the marbles, effort.
Okay. Welcome to Game Store Profits, where we talk about God, gaming, and Groots. I'm your host, Daniel Fisher, and along with me today, the Green Wizard Carolinas to my Peter Dickinson, Mike Perna. How you doing, Mike?
Oh, I feel so much better now.
You know, it's just those things you've got to get perfect in life.
Okay, so for the few people who are listening to us, did not listen to Barden Bible, where I broke down that Flight of Dragons is one of my favorite pieces of animation ever. I need to explain why it was so important that we get this right. Flight of Dragons is a cartoon that was nigh on impossible for me to find. In fact, I have a DVD of it, not because I found it on DVD, because that doesn't exist. I got a VHS tape of Flight of Dragons, a movie that was based off of a technical book about how dragons could fly if dragons really existed.
Yes. One of my favorite cartoons as a kid. It's not My Hobbit, which The Hobbit's my favorite, as these stories go, but
it's amazing.
It is.
If nothing else, if you leave with nothing else from here, there are two scenes that you need to see. One of them is Sir Orin Neville Smythe reciting his prayer as he brings down the dragon Briog. Watch that. I'm not even going to tell you about it. Watch that crap. If you do not feel moved, I don't believe you are a feeling human being. The other scene that you will see, I hinted at it when I was giving Daniel grief about messing up this line over and over again when I said, deny me and you deny all magic. Because the absolute end scene, the very last fight between Peter Dickinson, played by the late great John Ritter, and Omadon, the Red Wizard, who is played by none other than James Earl freaking Jones. You need to watch that. I believe both of those scenes exist in YouTube. Find them.
Heck, people, go out. I think you can actually buy this movie on Amazon Prime.
If you can do that, you do that now.
Yes. This is an amazing movie. See, these movies, as a child, me watching these as a kid, that's what shaped me. that, plus my mom's love for, you know, King Arthur and Merlin and all of that, that's why I flocked to Dungeons and Dragons when I got the chance, because I thought that was awesome and epic.
Oh yeah, no, I love everything about that cartoon, and the fact, like, oh my goodness, the voice acting credits in that thing are obscenely good. Like, oh, it's amazing. You definitely have to, like, yes, it does have a little bit of that, you know, 80s/early 90s cheese. Like, you can't avoid it. It's there. But my goodness, it's good. I just watched it not that long ago. It still holds up. It's really, really good. No, I try not to cross promote Bard and Bible all that much around here, because there's not necessarily a one-to-one crossover, but I actually, in all seriousness, I have an episode of Bard and Bible where I call it Punching Gorbash, and that's why I actually had to rip some of the audio off of my DVD, because in order to understand how, like, I personify the voice in my head that tells me that I'm useless and a failure as this nasally obnoxious dragon called Gorbash, because there's one scene in the very beginning of the movie where he's just so frustrated that they got this little, you know, pawn shop game designer to roll up and try to be the hero of all antiquity. And he literally just repeats over and over again, "What good is he? What good is he?" Like, that's like, this movie is important to me, people. I'm going to have to link that episode of Bard and Bible now, because this is important stuff. All right, then. Let's talk about board games. I'm keyed up now. I'm excited. We have started this off with a Flight of Dragons reference. I need to pour myself a glass of milk, because it's good for ulcers. And I need to sing "Oh Susanna" drunken in the basement of a tavern, because my goodness, it's Flight. I might end up watching it after we're done, just because I need to. Daniel, what have you been up to?
D&D, more D&D.
Did you have another Boy Scout game?
Yes, I finished the Boy Scout stuff for now. It was great. My daughter was there, and we had fun. But the following Monday, we had our standard meeting. Monday nights is when we meet. So we're sitting there, and we're trying to come up with ideas for fundraisers and things to do. And so, you know, like, guys, we got to plan out your year for the rest of the year. What are some of the things you want to do? And they're like, come on, let's go hiking, let's go canoeing, let's go bouldering, let's go camping. And, you know, we get up and we got them broken down in groups, and they all have a sheet of paper, and each little group's working on their list of things they want to do for the rest of the year. So I walk over to this one group. First thing I look down, Dungeons and Dragons. It's like, okay. So I walk over to another group, written down, Dungeons and Dragons. I think I made an effect on them. they kind of liked it. So that, and I've been cleaning up my basement, getting ready for a home game that the guys at work want me to run. So
I still think it's awesome that you work in a place where people are like, dude, D&D, yes.
Well, so when I got there, I had people coming to meet me because the people that hired me told everybody that I played Dungeons and Dragons and that I ran games. So, like, I had people come out of the woodworks, like, yeah, me and this guy in this building over here, we play D&D every weekend. And there's at least, like, three games going there right now.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I certainly can't say that. People look at me cross-eyed when I say that I still do that. And, you know, in my late 30s, they're like, why are you still doing that? I go, because it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's the adult version of getting around and playing poker. Well, the nerd version of getting around and playing poker.
Yeah, I am very excited. It's not going to be for the channel or anything, because my copy has not arrived. But I have discovered that a friend of mine is also a participant in the Invisible Sun Kickstarter, which has started to make its way to people in the world. And I'm actually going to be playing in an Invisible Sun game. And that makes me incredibly happy.
That's amazing. I'm happy for you.
So the goal will be that to have one day where we're just actually physically in the same spot and just go all in with character creation and have a first session. And then after that, we're going to be playing online because we're all, you know, full-grown adults with jobs and families.
Right.
But I'm very excited about this. If you're new to our podcast and you did not deal with hearing me constantly gush about how amazing this system looks, I'm a big fan of the Cypher system put out by Monte Cook Games. This, for all intents and purposes, looks like the next generation of the Cypher system. But the most interesting thing, the reason that I am beyond excited for this, is because the game itself, like, those of us who've played role-playing games as adults realize that you have to come up with creative ways as to why a guy is there one week and suddenly not there the next session. Like, we do, like, my old game group that I've been playing with for a while, they would say that anytime I couldn't be there because I was playing the dwarf, they literally wore me like a backpack.
You know, in my group, you know, the person just went on a side quest.
Right.
At DM's discretion. There's been times where we've had our DMs, and I've done it before, play the other person's character. As a DM myself, I do keep a copy of my player's character sheets. So at any given time, if I need access to know what they have on their sheets, or if I need to play their character, I can do it. So,
yeah. So the cool thing about Invisible Sun is that whereas most of the time we as players and game masters have to come up with a way to deal with that, this system actually has built into the mechanics ways to deal with people who are absent from game night. And so I am ridiculously excited about that. But it's a long way coming. It's another almost full month till that actually becomes reality.
I'm excited about that. Because I remember you getting that Kickstarter out.
I'm a little jealous. Joel blew my mind still, because he still sends me the updates, so that yeah. One is coming to me. But he blew my mind when he's like, yeah, no, I totally backed it for you. I'm like, excuse me now?
When you get bored of it, you can send it to me. I'll play it for a while.
I'm sure that will never happen. anyway, so before I get into the meat of what I've been actually playing, which is fun because I literally just got done playing a game of it with my wife literally minutes before we started recording tonight. I do want to bring up the one and only true segment of a Game Store Profits episode, the Archive Dive.
Sorry. Insert splashing water effects sound there, guys. Sorry.
You know, for the giggles, I might just have to find one. But in all reality, I probably won't, because that reeks of having to search through a lot of craziness on the internet. What it actually is, for those of you who are new to our home game here, the Archive Dive is when we look at a game that is at bare minimum older than 1 year, because a game can generally maintain hype for a year. But unless you're one of the multi-bazillion, you know, craziness that's out there, stuff like a Terraforming Mars, who is on its like seventh expansion, I think, or something like that, that really has proven to have staying power. Most games, even games that people were ridiculously excited for 1 year, suddenly the next year rolls around, the next wave of stuff comes out, and it just disappears. So, since so much of our listenership is filled with people who are brand new to gaming or are just discovering, you know, what the broader gaming world looks like, we want to make sure that we look at games that are kind of beyond that hype train, you know, collision, as it were. So, this game that I'm going to bring up is not especially old. In fact, I wanted to look up, it's only in 2012, which, to be fair, was, you know, 6 years ago, but not overly long ago. And this is a game that I feel really did deserve better than it got as far as reception. The game's called Trains. And, okay, brace yourself, because I'm going to try my hardest to pronounce this designer's name. Hisashi Hayashi.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm about the whitest dude that's ever said those that name in existence. Hisashi Hayashi. The thing I love about trains is that I have been on record on this podcast many times that says I enjoy a good deck builder. I really enjoy them. I like how you can play the same game vastly different ways depending on all the different combinations of the cards that are available and all that stuff. Trains did something that at the time I'd never seen, which is they made a deck builder part of an actual board game. You all are trying to build your train stations and your railroad tracks to connect as many cities as you can to get the points. And the way you do it is by playing cards that will let you lay rails and get trains and do all sorts of crazy other things to try and make your kind of rail yard the best out there. And it does all the stuff that deck builders do too. It has things like you're basically producing trash. When you create rails, you're also creating trash. And so you are literally filling your hand with trash. And so you have to then do all the stuff that other deck builders do. How do I get the engine going? But at the same point, how do I make sure that I don't overfull with all this nonsense and garbage? I love what Trains does. Like I'm not going to be one of those people who like talks down to Dominion. Dominion, the reason it has as many expansions and craziness, the reason it's still being played over and over again, is because it's good. But for me, stuff like Trains took what Dominion did, which is literally the first, like, as far as I know, the first major deck building game, the one that defined the genre. And it just kind of said, what if we did this, but we added something to it, or we put it in a different scenario. And this was one of the very first ones out there doing something, at least for me, something different with what was quickly becoming a genre-defining kind of mechanic. And so I don't think you'd get games like Clank if you didn't first have games like Trains. And so I think this is definitely worth looking out there and trying to get yourself a copy. You can probably get one pretty cheap. I think for a while there, they actually ran a trilogy box, which was, of course, AEG put out Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. And I believe they did a trilogy box that had all three of them in it. I've heard not good things about Planes, but Trains and Automobiles are both really solid experiences. So.
Did they do a Throw Your Mama Off the Train expansion?
Yeah, exactly. But no, I thoroughly enjoy it. There's also a two-player map that you can get really cheap that is well worth getting your hands on. It's really good, y'all. Just pick it up. And then we get to the game that I literally just finished. The game that I ended up actually getting at Tavern Con, because it's nice to be able to have the friendly local game store that's, you know, participating in your event be, you know, not necessarily owned, but powerfully operated by a friend of yours who's part of my D&D group. Mm-hmm. And so at one point I was like, man, I'm really jealous that there's a copy of Ex Libris in the, you know, the prize pool, because I really want that game. At which point he then reached in and grabbed me a copy and said, here you go.
Oh, wow.
When Ex Libris first came out, I couldn't not hear about it. I was at the Gen Con where it was released, and it was flying. And I'm like, okay, like what is this game about? Because at the time I hadn't heard of it when I was at the convention. And Ex Libris is basically, is this like Nerd Squared? Because it's like what nerds do when they want to be nerdy. Because this is a card game it's a card game worker placement game where you are playing as magical librarians trying to prove to the mayor of your village that your library is the best library around.
I got the best game library around. Does that count?
This game is all about, no lie, alphabetizing magical books.
Yeah, I don't advertise nothing.
This game is nerdy to extremes, and I loved every moment of it.
I think I might have to buy that for my daughter, though, because of the fact she volunteers at the library, and her job is to put the books back on the shelf.
Yeah, no, I literally, part of why I wanted, I like a good worker placement game, don't get me wrong, and I don't have that many, so there was part of me that just wanted it because good worker placement games, why would I not? But the other reason is because of the fact that my wife is down for all of this stuff. She almost got excited. At one point, I was like, hey, I think you'd really like this game. And I've said that before to her, and she goes, uh-huh, sure I would. So I just explained. I said, yeah, your magical librarians, you know, using your assistants to try and make sure that you get the books and you get them alphabetized properly on your shelf so that when the mayor comes by and his inspectors look at your bookshelves, that everything's right and proper and you have a good selection of books. And she goes, when are we not, why are we not playing this right now? And it really is all sorts of fun because, you start off with a particular library. Like I said, you have a library. And so mine for this game was the Dungeon of Deep Thought. And when you play, you get three assistants. Two that they just look like generic gnome characters with the pointy hat and everything. The third one is a special assistant for your library. Daniel, do you have any idea who the assistant for the Dungeon of Deep Thought is?
Yes, sir.
It's a gelatinous cube.
You know, I wondered what that was on your card when you sent us a screenshot earlier.
It's a gelatinous cube, my friend.
Wow. I thought it was like somebody rubbed those numbers off that die.
No, it is a little, like it's just, that's it cute. It's a cube. And my wife, Susan's assistant was, I forget, it was like the Forest Repository, I think was the name of her library. And her assistant was a Sasquatch.
I think I like the gelatinous cube better.
And so the special assistant, depending on how you want to play it, can do different things. Like, the cool thing about the gelatinous cube is that any player that goes into, like, there's an ever-changing collection of these extra rooms and buildings that you can go to. Mm-hmm. And some of them allows spots for multiple assistants to show up. So if I place my gelatinous cube right up there in the front, every other person who wants to go to that building has to either, they do give you the choice, either let me pick a random card from their hand, mm-hmm. or allow me to get a free chance to draw a card and place a card in my library. Now, depending on how many people you have playing, there are differing numbers of cards that you have in your library before the game is over. At two players, I was playing with Suze, and at two players, it's 16. The first player to get to 16 basically triggers the end game. So 16 cards is not hard to get out, especially if your hand is just working together or you're able to manipulate it to get the letters the way you need them to be.
Sounds like it'd be a fast game.
It can be, and it really does fall into my favorite kind of niche, which is basically the core rules of the game are not complicated. The vast majority of the rule book is taken up by just a list and a little further delineation of what all the different locations do. Like, that's the bulk of the rule book, because the actual what you do is really simple. At its core, your library has three spots that you can put your assistants, and it says you can either draw a card or shelve a card, which is basically all the books, all the cards are a section of shelf with a number of books on them. And it really is fun because they do the mechanic of whatever type of book you have the least of is going to get a huge bonus. So you're trying to balance the different types of cards in your library, because whatever you have the lowest of is going to be drastic. It's multiplied times three. So if you have a nice average of a lot of it, like I, by the end of our game, I was tied for the each of the categories that I had was at eight books of that, of those different types. And so I ended up getting, you know, 24 points because that was my lowest number. So it's real good. The theme is really interesting. It has all this magical craziness, but at the same point, a lot of the actual stuff that you're doing is really just downright silly. Like one of the locations is a yard sale, and it's just a way to get rid of all the cards in your hand that you don't want by potentially shuffling them off onto other players.
Oh, that sounds great. I like that, especially when it comes to just sabotaging other players.
Oh yeah, it's real. Well, you can't really sabotage because it's all voluntary.
Okay.
Which I like, because the idea is it's like, because there was one point, because there are two types of books that at the very beginning are going to be really good for you to have in your library and really bad for you to have in your library.
Right.
The prominent category, which in our game was the monster manuals. The prominent titles work that whoever has the most of them gets a huge pile of points, like 15 points. And it gets, you know, lesser and lesser depending on how many people have it after them. The banned books is another one, which for us was reference books, I think. And for every one of those, you lose a point. And so all of this is not, it's not only getting them all alphabetized. It's not only getting it so that you make a sturdy shelf, which is, you know, it's as many cards wide as it is high, which is a thing. It's not always easy to pull that off. So you're doing that to get points. You're alphabetizing them to make sure that, because anything that's not alphabetically correct, it gets yanked off your shelf. There's the prominent titles, the banned titles. Your library itself gets a particular type of book that the more you have of that type of book, the more points you end up getting. At one point I was just asking if this was put together by Uwe Rosenberg, because it's just point salad. Yeah, this was downright Feldian in the way that you get just points on points on points on points. But I loved everything about it. And it's really funny too, because thematically it's so brilliant, because the way they do the score sheet, you do the category tally, and it looks, they actually did it up like it's a bureaucratic form. It's like, how many of this do you have? How many of this do you have? How many of this do you have? Have you checked alphabetically that your library is proper? And then it's like, once you've established this, go to section B. And section B is all of the different points that you're going to get because of it. It's like you have 20 something points for here. You have minus six for here and all that. And then it goes, then go to section C, and section C is totally amounts of section B. I'm like, this is brilliant, because this is like library bureaucracy, the scorekeeping board game. It was so good. Everything is drenched in this idea that the mayor and his inspectors are going to come through and just make sure that your library is legit. I thoroughly enjoyed every moment of this. And I was worried, because the concept of alphabetizing a library is painful to me. And so I thought, man, there's no way I'm going to get into this. But, you do. Because the game also is not, you know, it's not just simply, identifying what the strategy is based on what's in front of you. Because there's one location that you're always going to have on the board. It's a way to get cards. It's a way to become the first player. That's always going to be there. But every round, you are changing up what locations are available, because you basically deal out a new collection of locations every round. And what's cool is that each one of them is given a number, and whichever is the lowest number becomes what they call a permanent location. And so that one will, for the rest of the game, be out there. You can believe that one is going to be there. You can bank on it. But there's also going to be two different locations. Towards the end of the game, I was like, I could have won a turn ago if we didn't lose that other location. If I still had that there, I'd be winning right now. I would be bringing home this game. But because of the fact that it was the higher number, it got ditched. And unless we were going to be able to make our way back through all the locations and use them all up and reshuffle that stack of cards, it's gone. And you can't rely on that mechanic anymore. So you have to be on the fly, just adapting your play style. It's really good. It's really, if you enjoy worker placement games at all. I don't see why you wouldn't like this.
But it's not really just a work replacement game, too. It's a drafting game, isn't it?
No, there wasn't any drafting as far there.
I thought you had to draft the cards for the.
You don't draft them.
Yeah.
What it is that whoever the first player is, you basically deal out two and then, like I said, you play that full round with those locations in it. But only one of them sticks around for the rest of the game.
Okay. All right, I get it now. Sorry.
So you are basically adding to this town of options. I will say, if there's anything that I will take away that I won't even say I didn't like, because it wasn't like this ruined the experience for me, because I had a blast playing this just with my wife. But I do think that some of these locations, when you're playing with just two people, you don't really get to see how cool they could be.
Yeah.
Like, there was one location, I think it was like the draft house or something like that. And it's basically like, at the end of this round, you'll deal out as many cards as there are people here. And whoever is in the first position gets the first pick of the cards, and it goes around clockwise from there. And it's basically like, whoever, like, you deal with the first pick gets fewer cards, but they'll get the best card. Whereas if you're the fourth player, you get a boatload of cards, but you're just like picking the leftovers. Like, yeah. I love stuff like that. When we were playing just the two of us, neither one of us had any interest in sending any of our assistants onto that location. Cause it's like, it's a lot of pomp and circumstance for what is essentially like two cards. But I could totally see, if we're playing with more people, if we had a full table's worth, that I would love that card.
Well, I need to talk to you about something very important, Mike.
Okay.
Crack.
What?
Cardboard crack, actually, is what we call it here.
Okay.
Magic the Gathering.
There it is.
I've been asked to teach somebody to play. I just don't. And this is all Matt Piercy's fault, by the way. I just want to point this out in the tavern. Because he posted a link to the Transformers trading card game.
I'm very curious about that game.
I'm actually excited about it. And I haven't been excited about a collectible card game in years.
There's no way I can pull off. If you're not in the tavern, one, please feel free. Facebook.com/groups/GameStoreProfits. Please come by and say hi to us. But if you hadn't seen that link, it's basically a news article saying that the people who brought us Magic the Gathering, not just Wizards of the Coast, but literally people involved in making Magic the Gathering, are turning their attentions on a Transformers collectible card game.
Now, the artwork is not this movie Transformers that we've gotten in the last few years. This is the old school cartoon/comic book art.
This is going to be, you know, my old man shouts at cloud moment. I'm so glad that that's the case, because the animated has and always will be my Transformers.
Oh, I know. And same here. I love it. My heart just swells for this. So here I am at work. I get a text message from somebody. Did you see what so-and-so posted in the tavern? Transformers is a tradable card game. We've got to get into this right at the beginning. And, if this is a coworker. So I get up and walk over to his office, and I'm like, you know, I haven't been in the tavern today because I'm
working. I'm doing my job.
I said, but that's fine. We can do that. But, you know, to get you to that point, have you ever played Magic the Gathering? He said, well, I played it online. Does that count? And I was like, no, it doesn't. So I'm to bring a set of two decks of Magic cards to work one day so on our lunch break we can play. Now, this guy has only other played one other collectible card game, and it's the Star Trek collectible card game.
Which, to be fair, is pretty outstanding.
Oh, I know. He's got every card imaginable. He still has them, and I'm like, you realize that there's a huge market for that right now. So, but he you know, played it all the time. Now I'm getting ready to introduce him to part of my world.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to lie. I looked when they announced the Transformers game. I think there's part of me that wants to just really spin this off, because I will fully just acknowledge that my desire to get into this particular game would be in not entirely, because again, these people made Magic. Magic is a good game.
Yes.
So it's not entirely nostalgia that would draw me to this game. But yeah, no, if a core set is not that expensive, I could see me at bare minimum getting that. And God help me if they ever come out with the Dinobots.
Oh, they're there. They're there. There's artwork.
I want a Grimlock deck like you could not imagine. Grimlock, especially when you're talking about Grimlock from the old school animated series.
Yeah, he looked horrible in the movie. The last movie.
I would get that, and I would have those cards if for no other reason than I would be able to stand at a table and just be like, me, Grimlock, let me destroy you. I would be that guy who would go to it. Like, I can't, there's no, even if I was in a better financial situation than I am now, I would still not be in a place to get into a collectible game. But
the boxes for I'm looking at the artwork right now. I'm sorry, guys, but like, I've seen some of the mock-up box art. It looks like you're actually buying the Transformers from the 80s.
I would be all in. I would go to a store and spend the couple bucks here, couple bucks there to get a Grimlock deck. When I was playing Magic, I was never that guy. I never cared. I would just made.
Oh, I was. I was
that guy. I just played randomly with the cards that I had available. I would vaguely try to put together themes which I could pull off, but I would become that guy to have a Grimlock deck.
See, this right now, the only thing that's going through my mind is like, woo, get on the nostalgia train, because this is all this is.
Well, and that's part of what I wanted to kind of transition into, is just this concept of nostalgia. Because as much as I love it, I think that the most ridiculous rendition of nostalgia that I have actually had to, thankfully, it's not been bad. I actually was a little bit geared up for it to be way worse than it was. But I went to, you know, internet blows with somebody about the fact that they need to get off their high horse about The Last Jedi.
I could see that.
And I said, look, you can love it or hate it all you want. Don't think that it's some kind of ruination of what the first movie was, because a lot of the things you're complaining about actually exist in the first movie too. You just are viewing it through the memory of how awesome it is.
Yeah.
I said, because I went on a pilgrimage, as it were, through all of the Star Wars, and you know, Netflix just had Last Jedi, it just came out. So I'm like, I finally get to watch it. I don't have to worry about going to the theater. I can watch it. This is awesome. And so I sit down and I watch it and I go, yep, this movie has some flaws. I don't care though, because I flipping love this.
What movie doesn't have flaws though?
That's the problem, is that there's been this argumentation that the original trilogy was flawless, and that's not the case.
It only had one flawless movie, and that's The Empire Strikes Back. I mean, yeah. Seriously, that's the only flawless movie of the bunch.
Well, I start pointing things out that, you know, if somebody were to look at that, if the movie came out now, if they're like we're going to make this new Star Wars movie, and it has these things happen in it, it would go insane. I remember when the first of the brand new trilogy came out, and everyone was like, Rey's a Mary Sue, she can't do anything wrong. I go, hi, Luke.
Yeah.
And then, the only thing that I go, okay, yeah, Leia is Space Jesus. That's a little weird. But, like, there's so many little moments. I'm just like, yeah, remember in the first movie when Princess Leia, for a while, went in and out of a British accent? Because if you watch the movie, you'll hear it. She was trying a thing, and it didn't work, but they kept it in the movie. But you don't remember that because the rest of the movie is so awesome. And I honestly think that when it comes to it's showing up left, right, and sideways in board gaming right now. Because I just did my Gen Con preview list, and we're going to do more of a Gen Con game thing as we get closer to the con. But I did my Gen Con release, and one of my honorable mentions was the Samurai Jack board game. I don't know anything about how that plays.
You know it. I don't care. I did Samurai Jack.
It's Samurai Jack. All they had me at the words, there's a Scotsman miniature. I'm in. Because that man is one of my favorite characters created in all of fiction.
I just want to tell you this. I mean, I'm glad you love Samurai. I'm a Powerpuff Girls fan. Compared to Samurai Jack, because they came out about the same time.
They did, but
but
you know, I fully acknowledge that game might be garbage, because it wouldn't be the first game that came out that was just horrible and stupid, that was based off of an IP. And even if it's not horrible and stupid, it just might not be a game that I would like. Because I will still acknowledge that, you know, when Firefly came out, I was excited. I could not shut up about how Firefly came out. And then I got to see Firefly, the first one, not this, you know, subsequent games that have come after it have kind of done different things. But the first Firefly board game is an extremely long, extremely dry pick up and deliver game. And I don't care about that. But even though I don't care about that, I still thought about getting it because, my goodness, you know, it's Firefly, mm-hmm. and I wants it. I don't own the newest one, the Brigands and whatever it is, the actual like miniatures war gamey kind. But they just announced that Shepherd Book's going to be in an expansion. I don't even own that game. I might buy it just to get a Shepherd Book miniature, because why wouldn't I? Like, nostalgia is this powerful thing, but it's also interesting to see what it does to us when it's not held in check.
Yeah, and when we get to run rampant on the new fans of things that we're nostalgic about, like we're the gatekeepers or something of it.
Yeah. And we've already discussed on multiple different episodes about the stupidity of gatekeeping.
Yeah.
But
it's real though.
It very much is real. It's interesting. Like it's fun to bring up logical fallacies in discussions of how good pieces of media are, because it's fun to watch people do the no true Scotsman, no true fan of this would be okay with this. I'm like, no, I know several people who are, but I don't know. I think that as we were talking through this, I'm blown away by the way our minds are capable of overlooking every wrong thing and every fault when we like it.
Right.
Yet if we don't like it, all those things come in blazing contrast. I'm just reminded on how so many instances, and we're seeing it more and more across all sorts of different, especially across social media and everything, the idea of, if you're a friend of mine, you deserve all grace and all, you know, all kindness, and we should just extend a hand of love and kindness to that person because I like them.
Yeah.
Even though they've done terrible things, even though they've done, you know, ridiculous things, I should extend, you should really extend grace to them because they're a good person and I like them. This other person, on the other hand, who's done similar things, sometimes even lesser things, but because I don't like them, my goodness, they need to burn. They need to feel God's judgment. They need to feel God's wrath, because those are the terrible heathens.
Right.
And I don't know, it's silly to me, but at the same point, we've been doing this now for, I just did the math, almost 7 years at this point. I've been doing this podcast for 7 years. I've been silly a bunch.
Yes.
But
especially with me.
But it's crazy to me that I'm in this mindset as we're talking about this Transformers card game, that it just reminds me how easy it is for us to manipulate our own experiences and our own memories, and how much we're required to look past that nonsense to understand exactly what grace is supposed to really legitimately look like. The audience at home is not going to appreciate this, but you have this pondering look upon you.
Yeah, I mean, because we kind of talked about this in church today, and for y'all at home, we didn't get to do our recordings on our normal day. It's Sunday night, the day before. You know, and we were talking about, it was more lines of siblings. And see, I have an issue that I have less grace for family members, and I think I've mentioned this before, than I do complete strangers. And part of it being is, you know, my family members grew up in the same type of environment I did, and they grew up with the same grandmother and the same, you know, upbringing and stuff like that, and they're completely different than me. And yet, you know, I hold them that they should be at a standard that I consider the gold standard, because that's the way I was raised. And when they screw up, I'm like, why did you all screw up? You know, and I hold them at a different standard. And we talked about that today at church, is about dealing with your family and having grace for your family and having a relationship with your family, because it's, you know, it's required. You should love your family and stuff like that. But yeah, it's just, yeah. I've been hit all six ways today from everything about grace, family, and grace. So,
yeah, like I will continue to say, like, this, if there's one topic in far as any theological or church, you know, just ecclesiological anything, if there's one topic that I will continue to hammer and will continue to bring home, it's just this idea that the most beautiful and wonderful thing about grace is also the hardest thing to realize, that it has to be offered to everyone for it to be real.
Yeah.
And it is so easy to appreciate grace for ourselves. It is so easy to appreciate grace for the people we care about. And it is such a weird concept to really understand the grace that says, no, I'm going to literally have to extend this to somebody who infuriates me.
Yeah. And I think that's the hard part, especially for people that may have, you know, jaded you in the past as well. When they come to Christ, it's, or, you know, it could be a Christian that just screwed up. But it's for everybody. And that's the thing. We each, it's an equal thing for every one of us. And it's not like this person gets more than the other person. And it's a way that we actually have to interact with each other all the time. You know, today my son's like, why do you not like hanging out with these guys? Well, they're family in Christ, but they annoy me.
Let's just be real about this.
I said, yeah, and that's what I told him. I said, I love them, but I don't want to be around them. And he's like, okay, I understand that. And I said, if they come up to me and need anything, I will be there, you know, right there with bells on to help them out. But outside of that, I don't go out of my way to hang out with them. And he didn't understand that. But, like, you know, I should have more grace for those people. Just because they're annoying doesn't mean I shouldn't love them. You know, and it goes that way for everybody, though. I mean, the drug addict versus the non-drug addict. And, you know.
Well, it's important to be able to set aside our own comprehension of these things. Because we will always see whatever is our people or our, you know, fandom or our whatever, we will always have this rose-colored understanding of what it was like. Heck, Flight of Dragons. We started it off, I'm bringing it home because, again, I love this show so much. I'm pretty confident. Now, as a guy who spent literally minutes, like long, probably painful for our audience minutes, talking about how important this stupid piece of animation was to his life. I love this, but I'm pretty confident that if I were to put that, heck, if I'm going to show that to Noah when he gets older, he's going to look at me and be like, the heck are you showing me, old man? Because, yeah, it was pivotal to me. It was super important to me. But, man, have you ever shown a teenager animation from the 70s and 80s?
Yes, and it's not pretty.
I have the quintessential example for you. Especially because I've been trying hard, because they did the new version that's on Netflix, and I've been binging the crap out of it because I'm so far behind. I, at some point or another, realized there may come a time when I have a small child. This was long before Noah was in the picture. I said, there may come a time when I'm going to have a small child, and I want that small child to experience some of the glory that I saw in my youth. And so I went out, and I bought Voltron on DVD. All of it. I have all of Voltron. It even comes in a Blue Lion tin because I am that nerd. And I've watched old Voltron.
Doesn't hold up, does it?
We're going to skip right to the Netflix one because the Netflix is honestly good. We are going to, I literally found myself with my 6-month-old baby in my lap the other day as like Susan wasn't around. So I'm like, oh man, Susan doesn't let me watch my cartoons. And so I'm just going to sit down. He's going to be asleep in a minute and a half. I'm going to watch Voltron. And I literally, with Noah sitting there, I looked at this kid who is pre-verbal. He does not understand words yet. And I just looked down at him and I said, buddy, Voltron was very special to your daddy when he was a little kid. This is way better than the Voltron that your daddy watched when he was a little kid.
Well, no, I actually experienced this exact same thing a few weeks back. It's because it didn't hold up in my son's eyes, because I've talked about it and talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. I finally said, let's start Akira.
Oh.
And so, I believe, and I think part of it is the hype train, where I've sat there and talked about it and talked about it and talked about it, and it's like the greatest movie of all time. And then they sit down, I'm like, Dad, this is dumb.
Well, and this kind of goes back. It goes back to the faith thing, the fandom thing, and it brings everything all together nicely. You got to realize that there are so many elements that make up your appreciation or, I don't know, unappreciation. I don't know what the proper term is of a piece of art or a piece of media. You mentioned Akira. For many of us here in the U.S., Akira was our first exposure to anything that was coming out of Japan, as far as there was nothing else. We got Akira in the back of the video store, and we felt almost dirty getting it sometimes. It was like we were smuggling something that we shouldn't have.
No. I'm gonna date my age right now. I got it because a friend bought it on Laserdisc.
Laserdisc. Fantastic.
And he then made a copy to VHS. And we all shared that because we weren't rich enough to have a Laserdisc.
Right. He was. And so, yes, for us, I will totally back that. I watch Akira through the lens of that kid who now has watched gobs of anime.
Yeah.
But it all started with Akira. So I can't not watch Akira through that lens.
See, I had a good heritage of Japanime upbringing. Akira, Bubblegum Crisis. This is the original Bubblegum Crisis. And the AD Police, followed up by the first Vampire Hunter D.
So, I mean, we see all that stuff through that lens. It changed everything. Even when I was talking to somebody about Last Jedi, I'm like, you don't understand. I've hung out with kids who were as young as I was when I watched the first trilogy, who grew up as going to the theaters to see the prequels.
Yes.
And they love them. Because it's written for them. The experience of going to the theater with their families is happening now. All the stuff that made me look over every flaw of the original trilogy is happening to them now. When it comes to, you know, we're in this the neck of being, you know, in the deeper elements of this. So many times we neglect to try to understand the reasons that people come to the places that they are. That yes, we see everything a certain way because of countless varying shades of experience and history and education and all this stuff. I've often said that two guys that have been both amazing as far as just colleagues, guys that I do this with, and guys that I would consider mentors just because they're older than me and have been doing it longer. Two guys that I absolutely love is my buddy Doug and Derek White. And both of these guys will bust on me for my theology. And I bust on them back because that's just what we do. Because there is all this stuff that comes into it. Our education, our experience, our study, our you know, interactions with other human beings. We have all this stuff that comes in to forming our theology. And so it's important for us to not just go to the "you're stupid and wrong and the things that you believe and hold to are stupid and wrong," because they come from a place. Or they should. The only time I never give credence is when people say, "I don't think God would do that." And I'm like, "He did it right here. So you need to deal with that." But as long as you've done your homework, I have no ability to look at you and say what you've done is stupid and wrong, because I look at your work and I say, you know what? I might not see that like that, but your argument makes sense. And I cannot fault you for that, because so much is riding on the fact that we want to overlook all the flaws when it comes to ours, when whatever it is, we overlook all the holes, we overlook all the flaws and all the ways that we are stupid and wrong ourselves, we overlook them, saying, well, I'm just human, I make mistakes, I'm a sinner saved by grace, and Jesus loves me, thank God. We cannot then, therefore, look at somebody else who is in that exact same place, who happened to just come up with a different reaction to it, and say, but those guys are idiots. When you have a full understanding of just how much you are willing to give yourself grace and how much you are willing to overlook your own stupidity and how much you need God to, you cannot. There's a parable about this, y'all. You cannot then turn around and say that somebody else needs to be held to a higher standard than you're holding yourself to. But that's what nostalgia makes us do a lot. So I honestly do hope that Transformers game is good, even though I'm going to have to find some way to get somebody else to buy it so that I can play it.
Well, I'll be investing money in it probably.
Good.
It looks good.
Yeah. Good.
I'll let you know how wonderful it's not.
I have a
feeling it's just going to be not great.
I don't know. I have hopes. I mean, again, the team, a lot of this team is what gave us magic, so you never know.
Yeah.
I'm going to end right now with this tagline. And if this doesn't work out, I'm going to delete all this. But after the tagline, if you hold on for a second, I can't not do this. Because if your world does not have the sound of two absolutely drunk off their butt dragons singing "O Susanna" in the basement of a tavern, you haven't lived. So after we have our traditional ending, should I be able to find this, I'm going to have an audio clip of them singing this. And all of us will be better for it. Go find Flight of Dragons, please. And even if you hate it, even if you're like, Mike, what is wrong with you? I need to know that somebody out there watched this movie because I said it was awesome, because more people need to know this existed.
I will say, Flight of the Dragons is on DVD and Blu-ray on Amazon now.
I need to go to what Prime Day's happening. Amazon Smile's a thing. It's a donation to Inroads. I need this.
Yes.
All right. So we'll get to the serious first, and then, Lord willing, I'll be giving you Peter and Smurgle singing "O Susanna," just completely hammered. Always remember, there's part of me that wants to do a cheesy spin-off line, like "Always remember, never let an ogre get a grip." Always sing songs, you know, to fight off sand mercs. I'm not gonna. Always remember, God is the game master. No matter how the dice fall, the game plays on.
I'll see to the dragons downstairs.
Oh, wine?
Wine not.
This isn't wine, it's mead, but not bad. Peter, how'd that Beacon Street song go again?
I came from Louisiana with a banjo on my knee.
Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me. Here comes Alabama with a banjo and my knee. Plucka, 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 plucka. I am ruined.
Man, I love this movie.